Chapter 41. Ruth, 1996. I am standing in the shower, still half asleep, letting the water run over my body. The morning light is white and peaceful through the silvery drops on the shower screen and the faint outlines of older drops visible beneath them. I am standing and letting the last of the soap run off, relaxed with that feeling of well-being that you get from water, from swimming or from standing in a long, hot shower. I watch my hands turning off the taps. They are pale and new-looking hands, solid and capable. I watch them carry on getting the towel almost as if they have their own agenda, their own good sense. And it strikes me, but of course they always did have their own agenda. My hands and my body always remembered. They were living my real life, getting on with what was really happening, while I was trying to live the life I thought I had. They remembered all the days I forgot, when I couldn't see how I had died and come back again, a body and a soul forever changed by fear. I look at those poor, white, dumb things and I think, it's okay now. I know you. I know our story. I wrap the towel round my shoulders, open the shower door and emerge into the chilly room. I balance on one leg, then the other, getting dry, rubbing down my skin. I am 33 years old, and I am slightly overweight for a smallish person. I have long black hair, a few grey hairs on one side at the front. I love chocolate almonds, and I hate the taste of nougat. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, and my body can go from 0 to 60 in panic for no good reason. When my palms sweat and my heart begins to gallop, when I feel like I have to run or fight, then I know I must stand and slowly let it all stop. I wait for the fear to finish drowning me, and then I start to breathe, start to think again. And I say, poor old hands and brain, it's okay now. We are safe. Then we remember our story, how we came to be here, and we are tired, but we are okay. I can choose how my days will turn out now. And my days are good. I pull on my clothes, twist my hair into a pleat, pin it up, still damp. In the kitchen, Michael is in his shorts and T-shirt, not showered yet, his fair hair tousled by sleep. Ewan, at 4, has that same mop of curls, only much fairer after a summer spent outdoors in the sun. Ewan has 3 tractors lined up in front of his porridge, multitasking, eating while making tractor noises and reparking them round the bowl. Emily, our little surprise arrival 6 months ago, is in her high chair. She's sitting with her tiny hands, one each side of a bowl of baby porridge, clenching and unclenching her fists. Michael is spooning it slowly into her mouth, shaving it off as they go. I take over from Michael. He puts a mug of coffee beside me as he goes to shower. Emily keeps her mouth open while we change shifts and gives a shudder of happiness when she sees me carry on with the gloop. As the spoon travels towards her, she fastens on it, and her eyes turn up and look at me, centre on my face. The porridge finally all gone, I clean her cheeks and chin and undo the high chair strap, lift her small, heavy weight and balance her against my shoulder. She smells of damp skin and oatmeal, and gently bangs her cheek against my chin as she wobbles. She sees a bird go past the window and lifts her arm. I carry her over, and we stand at the back door, looking at the sparrows fussing and hopping in the fuchsia bushes outside. I balance and rock her as we watch them and think, I can do this. I can do this because I changed. My body grew and swelled and tore, and I became a new creature, a mother. And I saw that all my old life stopped then. It was up to me to choose to let go, because me and my hands, we had to stop asking and we had to start giving. We had to stop fighting and start holding instead. I am 33 years old. I have black hair, I am slightly overweight, and I had a grotty childhood. I like chocolate, and I know no one is coming back from those days to say sorry for what happened. But I believe there's a sweetness and a kindness in this world that infuses the morning with yellow sunlight. And I am married to a man who is kind and loving. And I don't know how I got so lucky. I am 33 years old, and I am the mother of Emily and Ewan, and I am so, so lucky. The door goes. Leif arrives, comes into the kitchen and grabs an apron from the back of the door. "Hi, sweetie," she says, blowing a kiss at Emily. She grabs a hug from Ewan and goes through to the main kitchen to begin cooking the breakfasts. Leif has become the chef for the guest house and the evening restaurant we now run together. Her lentil soups and homemade bread and cheese soufflés always bringing the Sea House guests back for more. I hear her moving quickly around the kitchen, sliding a CD into the player. Cracking eggs, swooshing them into the pan of hot oil in time to a fiddle and a baran beat. She sings along in a phonetic approximation of Gaelic that Angus John tells me is actually rather good. I hear guests moving around upstairs, water running in the showers. At the moment, we've a group of 16 teenagers from Lanarkshire. A toot from a car outside and Ewan jumps off his chair. Vari, Donald Allen's wife, drops by every other morning to take Ewan to the little school, a two-room building in a spit of blonde dunes and sandy macha that stretches halfway out into the Sheelaboshed estuary. Land that looks far too fragile to withstand the winter storms, but it does, year after year. I put his snack in his backpack. Ewan adds a tractor. We go out to the car and he climbs in the back, chatting away in Gaelic to his best friend, Kirsty. I kiss him, fasten his seatbelt and wave to him until they are out of sight. The thing that has taken longest for me to cope with has been letting the kids take those small daily risks, letting them out of my sight. But I am working on it. Working out the difference between a real risk and a feeling of panic. The car is gone and I turn and go into the house. Michael has the back carrier ready for Emily. She's going with him and eight of the kids for a hike to Hushinish. She loves sailing along on Daddy's back with a tassel on her hat swinging from her little head. I hurriedly finish my coffee, kiss Emily and Michael, and head out to get ready for the morning. Down at the new shed that we built at the bottom of Angus John's croft, on a piece of land he sold to us, I unbolt the doors and open them up onto the sand. 10 kayaks in blues and reds sit in a rack under the roof, paddles fixed up against the wall, and beneath them the larger dinghy. Donald Allen arrives and we start to pull the dinghy out. Once the kids are down, I get them to help me unload the kayaks, check they all know what to do, a little talk on safety, and then we go down to the water. They've had a good 2 weeks to get used to the kayaks, so today we're going to do a slightly longer trip. I lead the way out, as we start to glide round the peninsula between the shore and the island of Tarrinsey across the sound. Nothing but the slap of the paddles dipping, the rocking waves like a dance partner as we measure the pull and swing of the water. Beneath us, the intense glassy turquoise and purples of the sea as we cross over white sand and dark rocks, heading out to deeper water. Donald Allen cuts the motor on the dinghy, lets it track in the currents, and we travel along in silence, the kids awed to be afloat on the sea. The surface of light melting into a view of deep water and caves of shadow. I think of Michael. He'll be walking out towards Hushinish Point in the distance in front of us, above the beaches where Ishbel first saw her man gliding along the surface of the sea. And I think of my mother's Selkie ancestor now as I paddle, pulling her skin boat up the sands, pulling off her sealskin jacket and shaking out her long black hair. The Selkie woman walks up the beach, and as she does, a woman in a yellow dress with long sleeves and a floaty skirt waits for her, wind fanning out the long black hair that is tied off her face with a chiffon band. I see how they talk together as they go. Sometimes they stop, shade their eyes and wave at me, just to check I'm all right. Before we turn round to go back, Donald Allen cuts the motor again while the kayaks make a detour into a cave beneath the cliffs, a silent space that belongs only to the clip-clopping of the sea. A mineral light, blue and vivid green, shines up from the water, throwing bright nets over the roof. Blooms of red seaweed and bunches of purple mussel beds, hushed by the quiet echo. "That's beautiful," they say. A tall boy with a stud through his lip, shaved eyebrows and scars on his wrists, his face thin and hungry, hangs there on the water, rocking. "Wow," he says. "You'd never believe it, would you?" At 7, we are due in Stornoway, at the Anne Lantier Arts Centre. The Hebridean Summer Festival is quite a big thing now, and this year the centre is holding a multimedia presentation, The Selkie, based on a book by Reverend Alexander Ferguson and Dr. Gordon McIntyre. When my uncle, Lachlan MacLeod, tracked down Alexander Ferguson's manuscript, it seemed incredible that the book had never been published, so I approached Edinburgh University to see if they could suggest what we might do with it. They seized on the pages immediately and were very keen to publish it under the university's name. A few months after that, the director of the summer festival approached us. He'd seen the manuscript and wanted to present the story of the Selkie and the Mermaid. The Glasgow Schools of Music and Art were going to take part, and there would be dancers and an audiovisual presentation with a huge screen at the back of the stage. The Anne Lantier Arts Centre is a lovely modern building with a large glass atrium. Sally and Lachlan are already there. Lachlan dapper in a tweed overcoat as he looks at one of the photos in the exhibition. Ewan runs up to him and grabs his knees, and Lachlan swings him up in the air. Lachlan kisses my cheek, shakes Michael's hand, and then gives us a tour of the exhibition as if he personally organised it, Sally following behind and unwrapping a toffee for Ewan. It's a small exhibition about Alexander and his co-author McIntyre's work on Selkies and Sammies. The manuscript is open in a glass case, with beautiful illustrations of the Ishbel story done by Alexander's wife, Moira. Ewan runs over to a tall glass case containing a delicate ghost jacket on loan from the Edinburgh Museum and presses his hands and face to the glass. Backlit, arms spread out, the jacket is made of material so fine it seems transparent. The bell for the performance sounds. The theatre auditorium is packed. Everyone we know and everyone we don't know from the island seems to have turned out. Angus John, unrecognisable in a dark suit, flashes us a smile. He has put his teeth in for the occasion. The auditorium goes dark. The screen across the back of the stage lights up, a grey seascape of moving waves. A booming low note fills the hall, and a single voice starts to sing above it in Gaelic, the song of the Sula Skerry Sealman. Emily grasps my hair in one of her fists and tests if it is well attached. By the watery light of the seascape, I untangle her fingers, kiss the top of her head and smile as I think of the last little secret that Christine McCauley managed to uncover in her sleuthing through census lists.